Skeptia Radio from London, a bilingual radio to listen and think.
The program, co-hosted by myself, Andre Lopez Turner, and Juan Toledo, in association with Extra Radio Uno.com, Artifacto, and Podomatic.com, welcomes into the studio this morning Brian Turner, the former Poet Laureate of New Zealand, the Commonwealth Poetry Award-winning poet, author of 10 collections of poetry, the winner of the New Zealand Prime Minister's Poetry Award, and numerous others, the Robbie Burns Fellowship, and the author of many environmental books as well. We welcome him into the studio, which is actually Aturihua, Central Otago, New Zealand, and London via Messenger to talk about poetry and environmentalism. Welcome.
Oh, thank you, Juan.
Yes.
Thank you, Andre.
No, thanks for being with us, Brian. Brian, let me start asking the question here from London. You are an environmentalist in the way you live your life. The poetry that I know of you, I have read 3 books by you. My question to you is this: what there is so little about environmentalism in poetry still nowadays? What do you think that is?
I haven't thought much about it, but it may be because there are fewer poets and writers who live outside of the main centres, who live outside of more heavily populated areas, who have a preoccupation with Facebook and Instagram to some degree, who turn away from having to cope with the occasional harshness and varieties of the outdoors, and who don't want to face the fact that despite what is talked about in New Zealand, we are continuing to contaminate our rivers and waters and transform our landscapes into something they didn't used to be.
Poetry has always been concerned with nature as a central theme, but admiration for nature and kind of lyrical poetry about nature, celebrating nature, but never nature in a way of us depending on nature, always we as the observer, the beholder of beauty of nature. I think has changed for quite some time now, but still we remain in the same position in terms of poetry and in terms of poetic production, aren't we?
I'm one of the poets who writes more about what's going on outdoors as opposed to indoors. I reflect on and am greatly moved and touched by what I witness in the environments around me. But I'm not an urban dweller anymore. I live in a small town in central Otago where there are approximately 30 people only, and I get the jitters when I go to large cities these days because the congestion gets to me, and I think that people are shut off from the world, aspects of the world around us that I like so much.
Juan and Brian, what I'm picking up is, you know, you talk about a lot of urban poets, so to speak, or people that do poetry slams and performance poetry, and that tends to be a very urban group of people, and that's always existed. However, you allude to the fact that poetry has always been in praise of nature, and I'm wondering, you know, you've also lived in urban environments. I would call you a poet of human nature and nature itself.
Yes, well, look, I've written a great many personal poems to people, about people. So, you know, I've written love poems and elegies and so on and so on. But I've also written elegies for the world around us. But I think I've got a considerable variety of subject matter and tone and approach in what I've written over the years. But I'm more and more in the vanguard, as it were, of trying to protect what we have left on this planet, of what nature provided us.
Absolutely. I think that, Brian, the relationship with nature is not that long, to be quite honest. If you think about the Greeks never stopped about how beautiful the Mediterranean Sea was or anything like that. You don't find that in Greek poetry. Homer was in certain ways indifferent towards the beauty of the landscape that surrounded him. I think the nature, I don't know if you agree, if you would agree with me, Brian, and also you, Andre, that the poetic exaltation of nature came from the Romantics mainly. And ironically, it came through the Romantics at the time of the beginning of the social revolution. And the social revolution matters because it's the moment when man starts to dominate nature. Now, we have reached a point in which, yes, we have dominated nature. But we have dominated nature to the point of almost to the detriment of our own existence in this planet. What happens, the way I see it, is that poetry remains stubbornly anthropocentric. And our relationship with the nature and the world, as is happening right now, and the most urgent problem, which is ecology, remains very kind of elusive and almost, it has been omitted or has been omitted for quite some time now from not only poetic but also artistic work. You know what I mean? I mean that we are still concerned with human nature and we are not concerned with the environment in terms of artistic production and even poetic production.
Yes. Yes, I see where you're coming from. If I can tie that down a bit, you're saying we're contradictory creatures and we're rather bemused or confused.
Indeed.
As to where we are in the world today and what our purpose is.
Indeed.
And whether what directions we ought to be following that we find it difficult to follow. We're walking contradictions. I am too, really, because, you know, I feast upon the variety of things provided for us at the same time as another side to me would like to go back to something a bit more primitive.
But, you know, you talk about the ancient Greeks, Juan. Rumi, the great Persian poet, he had a lot of his poetry was ecological, environmental, and mystic or spiritual. So they exist. And, you know, some of the English poets were environmental, you know, exponents of the word. Walt Whitman, the American poet. But I think, you're making a dominant theme here for me, which is man, woman, or human presumes that they can dominate nature.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe, wherever you are, your environment, particularly if you're more in a nature-based environment, you soon realize that that is an illusion. That, we've had storms here, and colloquially, they will kick your ass. Surfers realize that nature, waves and the ocean can destroy them at any point. Mountain climbers realize that the winds and the snow will kill them. But urban dwellers or non-environmental thinkers or maybe religious people keep demonstrating this idea that we're above nature. What do you make of that? And do you see any evidence that poetry may help to combat that viewpoint?
Well, yes, I mean, there might be the exceptions of certain things. I do think that the whole thing about nature, in the way that the Greeks spoke about it, and even up to the point of the Romantics, is to do about the wonder of being alive, the wonder of nature. I think there's an element that we have not mentioned here, and is God and religion. The moment that God disappears from the equation, the moment that we find ourselves alone in the world, in this natural world. I think the relationship with nature changes. In other words, the nature which is exaltated, the nature which is celebrated in poetry, until the beginning of the 19th century, I will say to you, and even mid-19th century, even the Romantics going to that, is about the wonders of the divine creation. But with God disappear from the equation, then we is man and nature. And then what we do is that we think that nature sings to us and constantly sing to us. But I'm going to quote Nietzsche here. Nature might sing to us, but we don't sing to nature. Nature is completely indifferent to us. We are the ones who celebrate nature, but nature doesn't celebrate us at all. That relationship is not a two-way relationship. It might be a two-way relationship with domestic animals. We still wonder a bit about how clever cats and dogs and or how entertaining our domestic animals are. But nature as a whole, we don't communicate with nature. Nature communicates to us. And I think that the other thing that we are in awe is how insignificant we are in the universe. And I just wonder if that's the element. We live in a planet that we have to look after, but at the same time, we know that this planet is insignificant in the cosmic sense of the world. And I'm talking like as an atheist here. And I just wonder if that's something to do with that. You know what I mean? I just wonder if, in certain ways, in other words, we are nihilistic about it. We don't see a future beyond, you know, beyond this world.
There's lots of truth in what you say.
Yeah.
Nature couldn't give a
toss,
really, a stuff about us. In many respects. But I remember the American writer Wendell Berry said something once along the lines of, until we saw the world around us as a community to which we belonged, rather than just a suite of commodities to be used in whichever way we wanted, we wouldn't live properly with and on this planet. And I think that is correct. But your diagnosis and so is quite true. From my point of view, if we were going to change, make considerable changes, we would have done so by now, I think.
Indeed,
and our numbers,
relative
to what was back in the past when we didn't have the means to go out there and rapidly convert and destroy stuff. Now that we've got the numbers that we have, we're cluttering up the planet in all sorts of ways.
Can I just bring this slightly in another direction, a little bit more personal, and say, what inspired or got you writing poetry in the first place, Brian? I mean, as a New Zealand guy growing up, it's mainly a sporting culture. I know that you played a lot of sport. But what sort of turned the corner? What was your epiphany to start writing poetry particularly?
Well, I started to write in my notebook to make sense of what I was feeling and saw. I found I didn't know what I really saw. Till I saw what I'd written. And when I'd seen what I'd written, I wanted to improve upon it. I wanted to be able to sing in a way in my own language. I wanted rhythm. I wanted to come up with metaphors and similes and so on, which struck one as it resonated for me. But I kept going back and back to my notebook and writing things down and working them through until I could be satisfied with what I'd said. And I was surprising myself for what I got around to saying. And when I want to make sense of the world around me and the emotions that I have, I turn to my notebook and write down until I can't write anymore. And then I go back over it and over and over it until I say to myself, that's as good as I can do with what it is that I'm saying. And I go and wait for another experience like that. It's a condition, being a writer. You just can't... it's got hold of you. it gets hold of all of us. That's why we're writers.
Mm. And that's very interesting. And was there anyone that you read or inspired you or that you took an interest early on in?
Yes, and New Zealand poets and prose writers that preceded me. A.R.D. Fairbairn, James K. Baxter, in particular, Alistair Campbell, and so on. I looked up to my elders. I think we live in a time now where the young don't look up to their elders in the way in which we did. I had respect for those who those who'd gone before me had produced. I think today the younger breed is not as anywhere near as interested in the older buggers like me.
And the ancestors, Well, some of them are. I would say some of them are. I mean, I think what happened is the artistic production and the poetic production has been expanded so much that you will find a lot of people who are not interested in the past, but quite a few people who take poetry in a different fashion, a different way, will do it. I think what happened is that the artistic production and the poetic production, therefore, is much more varied nowadays. But I wanted to ask you something, Brian. In terms of the nature and your relationship about your poetry and your poems, is it the case that when you write poetry, and you mentioned the word experience, it's more about the experience in the environment, in nature, than actually an idea that comes from you? You know what I mean? The poems come from the experience. The poems that don't come from the idea of the experience.
Mm. Well, yeah, from the experience largely, but as I said to you before, I think, I've written a hell of a lot of poems about socio-political stuff. I'm a political animal. I'm a founding member of certain environmental groups and so on.
Yeah.
And so I'm much more political, I think, and, you know, I go on marches against racial rugby tours and all sorts of things. So there's the personal and there's the rural.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I wrote about rivers and streams and mountains and what I find in the outdoors, but I also have one heck of a lot of poems about, love poems, really. Affection for, liking for, and so on and so on.
People don't realize that in order to preserve that world that you want to preserve, the world of rivers and valleys and trees and stuff, you have to become political nowadays. There's no way that you can do it without being a political activist. Because that's the world that we live in nowadays.
Yeah, that's right. I'm a member of several environmental groups, and for a while I was chairman of the Central Otago Environmental Society. You know, I belong to Forest and Bird Society. I was a member of the council of the, what it was called back in those days, the Otago Climatisation Society, but now it's called Fish and Game New Zealand, and so on and so on. So I think more than most New Zealand writers, I've had a broader political range of political activity, and I've often been called an activist. One guy sidled up to me a few months ago. He said, "I've always wanted to ask you this." He says, "Are you an activist?" I'd hate to be an inactivist.
Of course.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, Kwan, you allude to you bringing in politics.
Indeed.
I think almost everything in life is political. Food is political. Yeah. Nature, how we treat nature, obviously, is political.
Environmental poetry is political nowadays.
Environmental poetry is political. Yeah, well, of course.
Of course it is.
I mean, vegans are political.
Of course.
As I said, food.
Carry on, because I got a question for both of you.
Yeah, sorry, ask the question,
I wanted to talk to both of you about the ethical dimension, not the moral dimension. And how do you see ecology as an ethical enterprise, not a moral enterprise?
Ethics is a big subject. As I said before, it is ethical because you want to see the world around as a community, and that includes the nature and every other living thing within it, and not just a suite of commodities and so on to be used by the preeminent species, humankind. We need to have greater regard for the rights of other living things. You can go to an extreme. You go for some people, you know, the diversity of the botanical side of things as well, where, you know, species are
absolutely
extinct that ought not to. Yeah,
I totally agree with you. And then we got into elements like, for example, the rights of animals and the rights of plants, and we're going to things like vegetarianism and veganism. The ethical is the community, and the ethical implies to resign to this idea of progress or the idea of capitalism as we know until now.
Briefly, because you asked me on ethics and morals, because progress is a word which will get Brian rather animated. So just briefly, I mean, ethics, I once saw a book by the Dalai Lama called Ethics for the New Millennium, Not Morals. Mm-hmm. And I think what he was saying was that morals can be bent left, right, and center, rationalized, justified. Uh-huh. But ethics is more a black and white. It's a combination of right and wrong, as I understand it. So, you know, like tax havens, you know, they're legally there, but they're morally wrong. Slavery, morally wrong, but it was a law. So I think ethics, as I understand it, is a little bit more cut and dry. You know, some things are just wrong and some things are right, maybe.
But I concur with Brian. Ethics implies that there's something to do with individual and something with the collectivity. And morality is something more individualistic, when the ethics is much more collective. So the environmental movement, the ecological movement, is an ethical movement. It's not a moral movement.
You're reminding me of the extent to which people talk about development. Mm-hmm. And I find that a lot of what they describe as development, it results in destruction, degradation,
indeed,
and depletion. And so when you put that to them, they wince a bit quite often and say, and they just go back to saying, well, we've just got to develop the place. And I said, well, your development is destructive.
Yeah.
And maybe I'm also thinking here, when we talked about poetry, environmental poetry, you could then say, because of what you've just said before, Juan, that it's ethical because environmental poetry is more about the we, the community, the we. And a lot of urban slamming poetry is about I and me. So, you know, and as you could say, I'm learning from you two in the course of this one here, you know, the environmental movement is an ethical one because you're saying ethics involve we, the community. But our economic model that we live under is very much an individualistic, self-centered one. So I'll just
add... The economic model that we are under is not ethical, it's moral. A moral with a distortion in the sense. Brian was talking about the idea of progress. The idea of progress and the idea of development. Oh, that's another thing, the idea of progress. Idea of progress and development. The progress and development as synonyms.
I think we've got a poet and environmentalist here who has got a lot to say on the idea of progress.
Oh, indeed.
Yeah, well...
But the idea is this, how unethical progress is.
It's got to be unethical.
It is unethical.
It is unethical because, as I said before, a lot of what's termed progress is destructive. You end up in depletion, destruction, and so on. And that is unethical. It's, well, at best, amoral. It's inconsiderate to those who follow us. It's having a disregard for natural values and so on and so on. World of commodities, bugger it.
Also, guys, but a lot of people and a lot of people involved in development and business and money would they dispute this all the time?
Of course. If you don't make money, it's immoral. Not making money is immoral for some people. But not making money can never be unethical.
But I'm also aware that I think there was a phrase years ago that said we are here to serve the economy is here to serve the environment, not the environment is here to serve the economy. I think that was the phrase. So in other words, the development progressive crowd, they don't look upon the environment in any other way other than it serves us and them.
Yeah.
As opposed to this movement is saying we need to serve the environment. Yeah?
It is an interesting question because it goes into the notions of the etymology of the word economics.
Well, it is an interesting question, but I was also met an African man that said us Westerners regularly say things are interesting, and he would prefer us to say some things are wrong, like polluting your rivers and cutting down your forests to make decadent, materialistic things for you Westerners is wrong, not interesting, he said. To which I replied, I couldn't say much more than...
But I tell you what is interesting because of the world economy. It's a Greek word, and it comes from the word... house and manage, how to manage your house. That's where the word economy comes from. Oikos nemein. Eco in Greek means house.
House.
House, it means house. The Greek term from eco is house. So this is our house. And we are messing it up big time.
It's our one and only, yes.
The one and only. Only
eco is house and nomeke means
manage. Manage. Because from oikos,
oh my God, really?
Because I tell you what, oikos
the
and
economic.
The main, oikos and the main, oikos the main, economy. It means house and manage of the house. That's the Greek etymology of the word.
Right, and just to quickly interrupt here, because in the English context, the house is the Englishman's castle.
It has been hijacked. Words change meanings by anything. Economy now means progress. In the capitalist way, economy means the necessity of production, the necessity of employment, the necessity of providing.
Yeah.
The problem that we have, and I'm going to go back to poetry because we have to go back to poetry on this one, is this. We have so many wrong assumptions about things. Wrong assumptions about the length of governments, the electoral process. Electoral process nowadays, we have been hijacked by people. Look, we got Brexit here, we got Trump in the United States, we got right-wing candidates in Australia. Something I have to say, New Zealand is far away from it, which is so refreshing to see New Zealand as a beacon of sensible thinking compared to countries like Australia. Forgive me, and many Australians will crucify me for saying this, but that's the fact. And I'm going to ask Brian this question. Can poetry change the conscience of people through language alone? Can it?
That's a big question.
Well, it's language and the content that the language comes up with. I mean, I've got a poem here called Song After Pessoa. And I say, working in a grove of camellias, a gardener is softly singing a strange, unfamiliar song that's tenuous yet full of feeling. I sense as much as hear the melody, its source in private joy or sadness or grief. With fewer bonds, now it's free to lighten the air. What music is there flowing unheard? What songs unsung because we have no heart to sing, our convictions fruitless without courage? Her right to privacy's a wall between us, where the music's not. Only she can say what I hear embodies peace, if song alone can make us feel tenuous, complete.
Oh, that's gorgeous, beautiful. I like the musicality of it. Our convictions fruitless without courage. Totally.
Yeah, song after Fernando Pessoa.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, nice. Brilliant. Well, absolutely.
Through poetry and words, and we can sing and to other people, and it's a gift that humankind has. If only we can slow down a bit and listen more carefully and reflect. I'll read you just quickly another.
No, please, please do.
Blackbird. Well, here's Blackbird. When a blackbird starts singing high in the silver birch and dark's hovering, heartfelt beats heartless hands down. And it seems to those who hope to discern the difference between love and loveliness that the bird's song may be as pure as any will ever hear, and is part longing, part fulfillment, near unadulterated joy. And though one can't say that a bird wonders if remorse will ever run its course, that blackbird sings in ways that assuage need in a voice that's his alone until, miraculously, it feels as if I'm singing too. Him to me, and me to him, and both of us for all of us.
Whoa, that's a point of communion with nature. The blackbird is singing to you, and you are singing to the blackbird. I tell you what is very interesting, that is the difference between love and loveliness. For me, that encapsulates the line between ethics and morals in certain ways. Love is individual, subjective. Loveliness is much more collective. I don't know. Perhaps I'm speculating completely, but it's a lovely poem anyway.
No, that Juan, your reflection on that beautiful poem is quite frankly magnificent and extremely beautiful and profound as well.
Yes.
The two of you, I mean, the poem, those two poems, or all the poems in the new book called Selected Poems by Brian Turner through Victoria University Press, just as a plug, magnificent. But yes, you two talking about communion with nature and through poetry.
And what is communion?
Latino voice of Fernando Pessoa. Sorry. Yes.
Yeah, well, you got that poem. And that, you know, I thank you very much for how you immediately got what I was trying to say, and the emotions and that I wanted to, you know, I'm interested in what nature does to me and what we do to nature.
Indeed.
And other living creatures. Indeed. What they do for us.
Yes.
You got it immediately. But a lot of people are oblivious to it today.
And, absolutely.
No, and that is greatly worrying.
No, Brian, I mean, and it goes back to initially to our conversation. I was quoting Nietzsche, who, he's harnessed the poetic brute, so to speak, in the European tradition, saying that we confer to nature these human qualities, but nature is completely indifferent to us. But in certain ways, you talk about the communion. And I do think that Nietzsche, to a certain extent, is wrong. The Nietzsche I have read is wrong in the sense that nature can communicate with us. And nature does communicate with us in many aspects. And your poem is a reflection of that. And we feel that communion sometimes. And that's an ethical communication in certain ways. And poetry as a way, as a mechanism, to try to change consciousness. And I just wonder how difficult that is, Brian, for one of you. Andre, do you think it's very difficult to change consciousness through poetry? Or if not, because if poetry doesn't try to change consciousness, what does poetry try to do then?
Well, I think that poetry does try to change consciousness. It tries to illuminate, but as I said before, probably, we don't know what we think until we see what we've said or hear what we've said. Then we've got to examine it and say, does it hold up? Are we getting across what we wish to get across? How will it be received? And so on. Will people be affected by the emotions and content of the language we use in the context that we use it? And I think as I said earlier too, there's no finer way of saying things through poetry, from my point of view anyway, and it enriches us all. If you can write, if we can speak the language or write our language in ways that have an emotional content and a rational content at one and the same time. Yeah. And you know, you're talking about, you know, this consciousness idea. I mean, that poem or a lot of these poems, consciousness, awareness, once again, are words which are bandied around a lot in our current vernacular, mainly through spiritualism and yoga. And again, I would argue in many cases they keep going back to the self, the I and the me, not the ethical we. And that, as you said, was a communion with nature. And you can only get that kind of communion if you are in the nature or you slow down. So in a way, it's a kind of an active meditation that's been put on a page. But, you know, as a Londoner, Juan, and as Londoners as well as New Zealanders and Colombians, I don't know about you, but I know here, I regularly admire and look at sunsets, and often I have to tell people that they're occurring, you know, that they're existing, and they go, oh, and then they move on.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's not really a question, I'm just adding to this a little bit, but to actually slowly reflect on what is going around you, nature, both human and nature itself, is a very poetic act.
Yeah.
And we talked about being an activist before. What does that mean? And you know, we all need to act, and we all do every day. But our breathing is an act, mainly unconscious. But we you know, activism is not a dirty word.
Not at all. No.
Make things better. Make them better. Real progress, not material environmental destruction, but real progress. So you could say poetry is a very progressive art form.
I'm going to say two things. One thing is, in certain ways, a defense of what I can see contemporary culture. Culture moves in very directions, you know, moves in the Trump direction, but it moves also in the opposite direction. And it's this, I do think that now we, the human species, live more poetically. Now, how to live poetically depends on you. You might enjoy poetry to a program in which celebrities dance on television, or you might enjoy reading poetry, or you might enjoy watching a film, but we are more aware. There are more people who will be aware of the sunset and the beauty of a sunset, the photographs that you sent on Facebook, which were absolutely gorgeous. That awareness didn't exist in Dickensian times. Because why? Because they couldn't, because the necessities and the urgencies of the daily life were different. We might complain about how we are, but we are much more sophisticated human beings now, and we are becoming more and more sophisticated.
We have more opportunities today than we ever had before.
But
the choices we make with the opportunities that we have are crucial. We can make good choices or bad choices or vile choices. And because there are a lot more of us now than there was in the past, we have the abilities to destroy so much, much more rapidly and devastatingly than we centuries ago could ever have conceived that we would have got into that sort of a position. Now, it's a scary place to live now on this planet.
Brian, I agree with you. It's just scary. It's on the edge, too. And it reminds me of a poem. I'm going to paraphrase it. I'm going to give you the idea of the poem because I don't have the... I could read the poem. It's in Spanish, but it's Cesar Vallejo from Peru. And it's about a dead man. And it's about a dead man who one person comes and mourns him and nothing happens. And then the second person comes and then the third and things. And then the multitude comes to mourn him. And what happens? He resurrects. He actually resurrects. I will send you the translation of that poem after this program.
Yeah.
I will send you the translation. It is an amazing image. It is an amazing poet, Cesar Vallejo. And one of the reasons for doing this program, and I was talking to Andre about this, is because ecology poetry has existed in Latin America for a while, particularly Mexican poetry. Octavio Paz, in 1977, was talking about the necessity of rethinking the idea of progress. Octavio Paz, Nobel Prize of Poetry, brilliant poet, was talking about that. And with people like José Emilio Pacheco, who says this is called the planet Earth, but two-thirds of the planets are water. What is not called planet water? Just that thought, I think it's brilliant. Should be called planet water, not planet Earth. We are planet water.
We're actually made up of 70%.
Yeah, of course, we come from water. We come from water. If you accept the Darwinistic theory, we come from the water. So we are planet water. We are not planet Earth. What happened is, I'll tell you what happened is, and this is my intake, that I'm bastardizing the idea. We cannot talk on the water. We need to talk above water. That's the reason why it's planet Earth.
Well, there's a great rock band that I like called Tool, and they have a song where they talk about various events happening and various ways that humans are not behaving well. And just quietly in the background, there's this chant saying, learn to swim, learn to swim, learn to swim.
Uh-huh.
In between things. But, yeah, I mean, Cesar Vallejo, you know, he exists on the bookshelf in front of us.
In front of you, right now? Oh, my gosh, you have to.
And I love the idea, Juan, of Octavio Paz.
Yes.
I haven't read a lot of him. I've read a few of his essays, but his last name means peace in English.
Indeed.
That, you know, Paz means peace.
Yeah, indeed.
And I notice at the moment, just to really divert things, the Bolivians in La Paz, the peace are having
another issue.
Civil war, this kind of stuff after deposing their leader. But anyway, I digress. I think your point as well, we can be very... There is a lot of cause for progress and optimism in a good way if we choose it. And unlike Dickens, in Dickens's time where London was very smoggy as well and had a lot of the inequalities, etc., that we have, but we have the opportunity if we shift the narrative and the consciousness into an ethical dimension of the we, which seems to be running through... this conversation on poetry.
Can I tell you a theory that I developed in a London bus about the progress in the Western society? It will take me two minutes, actually. And is this, and is the inclusion, and I hope that Brian, I don't know, what I want Brian's opinion about this. The whole idea of the progress, which is is completely contradictory. It's like in certain ways Marxist, that it is so good, but at the same time has so many downsides. Is this the assimilation of the other into society? Okay, the first assimilation into society of the other came from children. Children, and came through poetry, through William Blake, Songs of Innocence and Experience, and it's about the poverty of children in London. And look at the literature of Dickens, for example. It's about poor children's orphans who are rescued, not by society, but a philanthropist. The selected few. Horrible. Morally wrong, ethically repressible, whatever. After the children are rescued, what do we have? The women. Women during the First World War came out to and started to participate in the bellic industries. And this sounds chauvinistic, but once you get the women out of the house, they are not going to go back so peacefully. They knew that they could have things. So women started to ask for the vote, which they got between the wars, in particular in the United States and Britain. When did women got the vote in New Zealand? Out of curiosity, do any of you know that?
We were the first country in the world
where you are.
To have women.
Bloody hell! New Zealand always surprises me, being so forward-looking. Anyway, after women, what do we have? After the Second World War, we have the ethnic minorities. Why? Because the ethnic minorities about Europe, because the ethnic minorities were needed to reconstruct Europe. After the ethnic minorities, who do assimilate into capitalist society? The gay people. Gay homosexuality became decriminalized in 1967. One thing is decriminalized, culturally speaking, culture was a little bit behind, sometimes, not always, but it was decriminalized in 1967. What happened after the homosexuals? People with disabilities. Then we introduced the people with disabilities. What happened after people with disabilities? Animals. Bullfighting is going to disappear. Because we are going to understand the right of the animals. Not only that, the way that we eat and consume animals, we have to change. We will have to become vegetarians if we want to preserve this planet with the number of people that we have. And that what will happen after animals? Plants. And Brian was talking about that. The kind of the botanic world will have rights. Thus, a progression of ethical living in which you are aware of your environment is a top one, and is in the way that we are going.
Yes, that's a marvelous take, Juan, and I'm aware of those stuff too, but you couldn't have said that better. There's so much truth in that. But you know, we have a lot. You know, I'd say we have a lot more work to do. You know, with the Extinction Rebellion, yep. Quite strongly millennial driven. You know, I share your view of an evolution which is happening amongst us that has an environmental and ecological outlook, big time.
But I want to ask Brian two questions. One question and one petition. A petition is, read a couple of your poems. I would love to hear a couple of your poems right now. And the question is, how can poetry play a role in changing consciousness? Are we too optimistic about the role of poetry or not? So it's a question with a doubt.
Yes. I'm going to have to think, how can poetry change things for the better? Well, it can speak the truth in evocative ways, in musical ways, in pointed and sometimes acerbic ways. You can use all of the tools that we have verbally and what we end up putting on the page. It has to resonate, it has to have a considerable impact, it has to make the reader say, I hadn't seen things that way, I'm going to have to ponder and think about this. And if a writer can get that sort of reaction from what he or she has put on the page, then you've done something extremely worthwhile from the point of view of the reader and the writer, and one hopes a increasingly greater percentage of the population. Yeah. Can I just add, I think, you know, poetry says so much, so strongly, in a very short, condensed period of time that, you know, we are told all the time that people have got short attention spans, and they do, and they also don't as well. A lot of people are listening to some very lengthy podcasts. So, however, you know, poetry is very succinct and very short and very direct. I would add to that. Have we found a poem to read, or are we still searching for one here in this studio of ours where we're looking out at snow-capped mountains.
Well, yes.
I'll read you a poem
called...
And then are we going to round this conversation up?
Yes,
we will round the conversation up.
I think so.
But may I be demanding here from London to you in New Zealand? It is can Brian read two poems, not one but two, please?
Yeah. All right. Well, I'll read this short little.
And then we talk about it, and then you get a second one, and then we wrap it up.
Here's a jotting. It's hardly a poem. A jotting I made in Ladbroke Grove in London. I was down there one day and I came home and I jotted in my notebook, a woman in a cafe said I looked like a writer and asked me where I was from. When I told her, she said she didn't know there were writers in New Zealand. And by the way, where is it? I refused to answer that because too many know already.
Brian, did you read that poem in London? Did it happen to you in London?
Yeah.
Yeah, you are.
It's called Ladbroke Grove.
Anyway, here's another one called, here's a poem simply called Pig. He was a big pig, ugly to some, with a rough hide and thick bristles. When it was time to slaughter him, you shot him in the head and he slumped on the spot, stunned. Two of you couldn't move him, so you hung a block and tackle from a tree, stuck a hook under his jaw, and hauled him up. You had to use your four-wheel drive Toyota to lift him. He was such a weight. You gutted and hosed him out and left him hanging there all night. I saw him swinging slowly in the wind, a stain in the dark, heavy as grief.
Whoa, that's a poem for vegetarianism. Brilliant.
I know, that's what I thought.
And remember, the pigs are one of the most intelligent animals.
And also it's got what I like about poetry, irony and ambivalence.
No, hanging like grief, hanging like grief.
The humans or the pig?
Yeah, well, exactly.
Who are the pigs? The pig or the human?
Yes. Oh, God, yeah. Yes. Absolutely. Oh, brilliant. That's a brilliant point.
And what do you want to do the country matter?
Oh, look, this is a bit of a cheeky one, and I'll stop and what, as we say in New Zealand, piss off after this.
Okay.
But country matters. I invited her outside in the dusk, this leggy woman I knew. We raided through reeked grass, splashed through the river, and stole up on the quaking pond. Buttercups twinked in the soft light, and a horse rested under willows on the far side. I touched the lady's bare arm and smooth thigh, pointed to a fat frog croaking and staring pop-eyed like a lovesick moneylender. She whispered in my ticking ear, "It's either petrified or transported." I panted, "Forget the frog. Night time is pond time." The sated moon was up by the time we waded back across the river.
Oh,
there we go.
Nice. Thank you very much. That's lovely. Well, it's a nice way to say sort of. So in a New Zealand sort of way. You have to wrap it up, Andre.
Yeah, no. Well, many thanks, Brian, for joining our show, the program, which you can listen to on www.podomatic.com and Artifacto. On behalf of Juan Toledo and myself, we hope you enjoyed this, and if it has stimulated you or you can stimulate us, all the better for it as we march forward into the new realm of the ethical we community, combining poetry with environmentalism. So thank you very much.
Septia Radio from London, a bilingual radio to listen and think.